I am so glad you could join us. I'm your host, Mo Gaudat. This podcast is nothing more than a conversation between two good friends sharing inspiring life stories and perhaps some nuggets of wisdom along the way. This is your invitation to slow down with us. Welcome to Slow Mo. Welcome back. My guest today is Hannah Lord. Hannah is a psychologist and a therapist who believes that there is a better way to be a therapist and to help others. I met her, interestingly, in the streets of London as I was crossing the street and someone shouted, Mo! And I was like, okay, hi. And she said, I was just talking to Carly about you. And Carly Myers, if you remember, was my guest here on the podcast early in the year, an amazing human being. We became very good friends after our first conversation. And Hannah is a friend of Carly who has been listening to my mini series on love and romance, who sort of disagrees a little bit because my series so far has covered more what a woman's view of dating and love and romance should be than men. And most of Hannah's work is about really teaching alpha males, alpha masculines, how to maybe communicate more, connect to their to themselves and their emotions more, and accordingly, hopefully, find better relationships. Even her online training, The Weight Lift, is entirely about trying to teach men how to be okay with therapy. If you think about it in a sort of like going to the gym approach, Because of the creative freedom you guys give me here on the podcast, I think it didn't take me more than a minute or two to say to myself, I will hopefully ask her to be on my podcast, and she might say yes. And so there she is. We'll start our conversation in love and romance to continue our mini series, but I think there are many, many other topics that I'd like to ask Hannah's view on. So Hannah Lord, Hannah, thank you so much for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here, really. And thank you for letting me accost you in the street like that.
It was an honor, honestly. I mean, I was rushing to a meeting, and honestly, I wasn't paying attention to anything. And when you said Mo, I thought it was the person I'm meeting. And but it's a small world, because believe it or not, on my mind, I was still thinking that we haven't really addressed the masculine side, if you want, of relationships. And I'll be very open and honest. I'll start with a question that relates to me personally, if you don't mind. Do you believe that it's now easier or more difficult for a man to date?
I'll preface by saying I'm an eternal optimist, but I think this is the most difficult time to be single than we've ever had before. And maybe that's it's a bold statement. You know, there's been decades where people have been through wars and been separated, and you know, the numbers of men were dwindling, but I think the way that men find love and relate to women is getting more and more difficult all the time, and I think that's a real shame, and we need to come together to work through that.
I have to agree. I mean, it's interesting. As I said, I'm asking this question from a personal point, you know, place, basically. Mm-hmm. Because it's not a secret that person in my place, with, you know, the being known and so on, it's not difficult to go on a date at all. As a matter mm-hmm. of fact, you know, in my economics mind, I have more supply than demand when you really think about it. But the problem is getting a date that I believe is someone that is what I'm looking for, in a way that is able to let me be exactly who I am, is actually quite a challenge, to be honest. It's a mix between the expectations and the norms and the messiness of the process that I think is putting us now in a place where I would agree with you, it's never been more difficult to be a man.
Well, I'm really interested to hear more of your experience, because my belief is really that a lot of what gets us in trouble in relationships and finding love, or certainly looking for it, is that we don't fully connect with ourselves yet, but I know that you're,
understand, very enlightened. I'm not that well connected to me yet. That's true, actually.
But I think it's really, really important. And there's actually, for healthy human beings, there's almost like an alchemy that has to take place in love and finding true love, which I'm happy to get into in more detail. But I do think that what gets in the way is our connection with ourselves first and foremost, which we have to have at least a base understanding of before we can ever really connect with another human being. And that is what's getting more and more out of kilter, which is why I think it's more difficult now. Because if you look at the landscape of what's available to us, people talk about this stuff all the time, but our digital landscape makes it so difficult. We're more disconnected than ever, even though we're connected online. We don't relate to each other in the same way. We're still dealing with certain things that came up from the pandemic. Again, I know everyone's bored of talking about that, but it left a massive mark on people.
I believe that.
And really changed the way that we understand and relate to things, and also our fear about what connection means. So there's a lot in the ether.
That last statement hits home really deeply, actually, because so you started by saying if you're not connected to yourself, you're not able to connect properly in a relationship. And the idea of what a connection is, I think, in our modern world is becoming more and more challenging when you really think about it. A couple of weeks ago, I hosted Julianne here on the podcast. I turned it into my own little therapy session. Annie, before that, turned it into my very own little therapy session. And somehow I'm okay with that. I'm okay with being on therapy in public. That's an encouragement for everyone. And today in the afternoon, I was with my lovely co-author, Alice Law, and she was also turning it into a therapy session, questioning why is it that I make the choices that lead me to a relationship that's not sustainable. And I think that's, in my current mind, it's something that I do. So I actually stopped saying that it's something that the person I date is doing. It's clear in my mind that there must be something that I'm doing that sort of gets a woman to behave in a way that's not what I want from a woman, if you think about it. What that is, we'll get to the therapy in a minute, but I will agree with what you said. It's so difficult. It really is. It's, you know, I think men seem to have the golden years of I can get any woman I want, right? But the problem is I'm not getting the woman I want. I'm getting every woman, right? But not the one I want. It's actually so complicated in this incredible market dynamic of immense supply to actually find what you're really looking for. And because we men look at the world very differently, we end up in a place where we're not expressing that frustration at all, because it seems that, you know, every now and then I'm with a wonderful, gorgeous woman, then everything's okay. It's not. And I think this is really the hardest I've ever experienced dating and romance.
Yeah, I think, and again, I want to be careful not to generalize, Mo, but I think previously men and women to a certain extent, you know, there'd be that flurry of dating maybe in your 20s or earlier or whenever. And there is that, you know, wanting every single cookie in the jar so much that you can't even get your hand out of the jar anymore, that just so many options and just wants to enjoy them all, and then would reach a time when they think, okay, I'm done with that now, I'll get married. And I think now the options have multiplied so much, they're no longer reaching that point where they think, okay, I'm ready to settle down. There's actually just a fatigue of, I can't do this anymore. I'm just tapping out. I'm meeting so many people that have, because layer on rejection fatigue from being on the dating apps as well. And I think that there's that fear of rejection, that fear of having any pain, they'd rather just not engage because it's just an easier option. And I think that's what's really sad.
Yeah. I mean, I was talking to Alice today about my constant tendency to dip in and out of monkhood. The minute it gets so complicated, I'm no longer saying, how can I work on this? I'm more interestingly saying, maybe I don't need this anymore. Maybe I can just focus on whatever my life is all about, yeah. really, which is more important for me.
I was just going to challenge that, if I may, that yes. it, because of course we tell ourselves these things of, it's more important that I focus on work right now. It's, yeah, you know, there are more pressing things. This is going to help more people. That's the right thing to do. But it's also a way of hiding, isn't it? It's a way of avoiding that difficult situation of being in the discomfort of the unknown, of not knowing. What do I do now? Who is it that I want? How do I find what I need?
Yeah, it really is almost a masculine way of prioritizing what matters to you most, right? But what matters yeah. to you most is not just the topic of what it is that you want most. It's also what it is that you can achieve with the effort available to you, right? If writing another book takes me 2.5 months or 4.5 months, and finding the right woman takes me a lot of effort over multiple years, then I'll probably prioritize books. And in a very interesting way, I enjoy books as much, if not probably more. I mean, I really like to write. It's something that I really enjoy. And yeah. I think that the idea here, I'm trying to build a picture for our listeners, because the majority of our listeners are women, 60% or more, that it's actually not easy at all. So Jordan Peterson speaks about, I don't know where he gets that stat from, that a few men, 20% of men, get most of the interest from women in the modern world because they come across as the alpha men that are successful and so on. And that basically is leaving most men struggling and, you know, lonely. But what I'm also trying to say is that even those alpha men are very unhappy, because the reality is that an increased abundance of supply is not really fulfilling the real need that is actually, you know, like you rightly said, some men will remain their entire life just jumping from cookie to cookie, but most men will always eventually say, where's my cookie, right? Where's my coffee machine, yeah. right? And I think the reality is, it's really not that easy when you think about it either way, whether you're yeah. in the top 20% or in the remaining 80%, it's not.
Yeah.
How is it for women?
Oh, it's a nightmare.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's a nightmare for anyone who's single at the moment. I think it's really confusing. And I think that we are, like I said before, we're not communicating. We don't have the language to talk to each other anymore. And fear is so prevalent that it's really getting in the way. The reason that I love to work with men, and the reason that I think, because I think there's so much to offer everyone. And I have to say, my private practice is diverse, lots of different across men and women, and lots of different personality types, ages, etc. However, I love working with particularly alpha males, because they tend to be very logical. You know, they want things to be straightforward, and they don't want any bullshit. So they don't want any, you know, therapizing or yeah. and yet so many of them, and I'm getting an increase, I'm seeing the numbers of men who are coming to me increase, because they know something's wrong and they're deeply unhappy and they're deeply stuck. And it's often in their 40s, interestingly, you know, where they've had that drive of their 20s and they've just been climbing the ladder and chasing after what they want and, you know, going for success, going for women, going for everything. And then they either get it and realize that that's not satisfying them, they're not happy yeah. enough. Mm-hmm. And then what happens? Or they just completely lose their motivation. They feel like they've lost their energy. They've lost their you know, joy for life, their driving purpose. And again, they just feel a little bit stuck, like they don't know what the rules are anymore. But I think it's interesting, because the one of the fundamental things that you need to understand about therapy is that, about psychology rather, is that two things can be true at the same time. Now, that blows the minds of most men, because yes. they want the logical, 100%. Like, no, sorry, no.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But paradoxical yeah. thinking is a property of the feminine, I always say. You know, it's like, you yes. know, if men, we want black or white, right? We also yes. are happy with grayscale if you tell us exactly which point it is on the grayscale. We don't want black and white at the same time. That doesn't work for our brains.
But if you would be open to the concept of balance in the world, of that kind of harmonizing. So beyond, and I might lose you here, Mo, but in terms of, I might lose your respect here.
I may be doing fine.
Well, we have the body and we have the mind. But beyond that, there's also something extra. And that is the soul, if you like. I don't know if that's, you know, aligned with your thinking or not, 100%. But whatever people, yeah. So there's the soul. Now the soul has two equal parts, which is actually the, if you consider it, you know, the yin and yang, the masculine and feminine, and they are in equal parts, irrespective of your gender, doesn't matter.
100%.
And actually, a lot of this, what we're seeking are parts of ourselves that are not actualized in our human form. We're kind of seeking that in another. I'll get into that in more detail. But the truth is that, and I'm struck by the fact that today you're wearing black and I'm wearing white. It's fully harmonized.
Yeah, perfect. Exactly. Yeah.
But we're not allowing for the nuance of our, so for myself, it was my masculine side. And for men, it's often their feminine side. And the fact that they might be driven, they might want all these things, but they also want to be loved and cared for. They also want to be affectionate, by the way. They want to be soft. They want to be free and more creative. But that side is suppressed.
Is that not understood?
What do you mean?
Do women not know that about men?
Do men know that about men? Because so often it's seen as a weakness.
Great. Yeah.
That's the issue, I think. Do you disagree? This is interesting.
Not at all. I mean, so look, you've listed quite a few facts, really. One is there is yin and yang in every single one of us. It's not 50-50. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, in my case, it's 58-42, right? That's my masculine speaking because I developed a tool to measure it, right? But I'm 58 on the feminine. And that doesn't mean that I am terrible at logical thinking. I am, but I also embrace paradoxical thinking. You know, logical is on the masculine side, paradoxical is on the feminine side. And, you know, and I think the idea is that you're spot on when you say it just is seen as weak to be in your feminine, whether you're a man or a woman, believe it or not, in the modern world. It feels unsafe, it feels less in control, but oh my God, it's so much more fun and it's so much more playful and it's so much more nurturing. And it, you know, it really is. I've been, luckily, honestly, I mean, I'm very grateful to have had women in my life that allowed me to be more open to my feminine side. I'm a manly man still, every man will say that, just as a disclaimer, but yes, in a feminine way, if you know what I mean. You know, nurturing is not necessarily unmanly, okay? It's feminine, but not unmanly. And I think I don't disagree with you at all. What I was wondering is, most men that I know, unless they really have issues, and some men, I will openly say, have issues, some women also have issues, most men will want to live that life. And when they find the right person, they will want to allow those instinctive, sometimes feminine qualities to show.
Yeah, absolutely. And some men really love to see masculine traits in women as well. But quite often the ego gets in the way. Quite often our social conditioning gets in the way. And that's why I think the work is so important, so that we understand ourselves, we understand where we're operating from before we engage or can engage in healthy relationships. And I always look at it like a set of data, right? So if we look at the self, or how the brain's made up. Let's try and use a masculine framework so that I'm not going on about the soul too much and alienate everybody. We kind of have two separate parts to the mind. We've got the more archaic, the reptilian brain, which is the limbic system and the brainstem. So that's more like how the brain was formed before we then evolved and developed the prefrontal cortex as human beings. So the prefrontal cortex. So if you imagine those two parts, it's like the conscious and the unconscious, I think is a good way to map that. So the prefrontal is where we're dealing with the present and what we're doing and what we're processing in the here and now. Very logical, very, you know, this is what's happening. This is what's in front of me. This is the data set that I'm working with. The older side, the more reptilian primal brain, is living in memories and feelings. And it's there to keep us alive. So it's heightened all the time. And its basic message constantly is this safe? Is this safe or is this dangerous? That's all it cares about. Nothing more than that, basically. And so the two can sometimes be at odds with each other. And that's why we'll react to things so bizarrely sometimes. Like a basic example, imagine you've been working all day and, you know, it's been a stressful day and you've arranged to meet your your girlfriend for a drink somewhere, for a coffee somewhere, and she's running late. That's not a big deal. She's also got a high pressure job. It's, you know, these things happen. However, when she arrives, you know, you're a little bit cold with her, you're a little bit distant, and then that carries on, and you just, for some reason, you're really, really annoyed with her, and it doesn't quite match. You know, she was 10 minutes late. However, your limbic system, the older part of your brain, is holding the feeling of remembering not being met at the school gates, of someone not picking you up, not being there for you on time, and being abandoned. So you're waiting for your girlfriend, and then, you know, the server asks you if you'd like a drink and if you're okay, and you feel humiliated and shame, and you're furious, and it all escalates because you remember the teacher asking you a similar thing and feeling embarrassed that your parents weren't there. You know, this really old stuff, but unless you're aware of what's happened there, what's actually been activated, and that it's got nothing to do with your girlfriend, that it's some past pain that hasn't been processed, all of this stuff gets tangled up, and we just act out at people and project onto them.
Correct.
And there's this disconnect. And then she'll be telling herself a story about why you're being like that, and you've probably played into some of her material, and this goes round and round and round.
But then there is no hope then, is there?
Oh, no, there's loads of hope. All we need to do is just understand ourselves better. And that's why I'm on this mission that everyone starts looking at their own psychology. Because that's what is so important, is that I never wanted to be a psychotherapist. I had no interest in it. Full disclosure, I was in a difficult relationship myself a few years ago. Absolutely wonderful man, brilliant in so many ways, but I didn't understand myself fully. I think he also had some work to do, and we were just...
You're so nice in the way you describe it. When you're saying, you know, I didn't understand myself fully. He also had some work to do. I'm guessing that in your mind, you're going like, and he was a freaking maniac. But you're so diplomatic.
Oh, you met him.
Positioning it.
So I went to therapy to understand, you know, how to deal with that better. And immediately found that actually a lot of it was my stuff that I hadn't processed and hadn't realized. And I found it so illuminating, so exciting, and immediately like, oh my God, why didn't I know this before? And I just had this kind of voracious appetite to work through stuff. And it was actually my therapist who said, you're really getting carried away with this. Have you ever thought that you might want to train as a therapist? Yeah. And I was like, okay. So I went just as self-development. I thought, I don't want to do the actual therapy work, but I want to know as much as possible. But within the first, and it was a years and years. And of course, so they say you can only take your clients as far as you're able to go yourself. So all of the training in psychotherapy is really going into the deep, dark places and working on yourself alongside how you would then use that with clients and how you would help them. So, you know, while I was doing that, I just kept thinking, why isn't this taught in schools? Why isn't this stuff readily available to people? And look, it's, you know, it's very complex, but there are so many very simple things that even within the first 6 months of my training changed things indefinitely for me, completely transformed things that I thought would never be fixed, like my relationship with my father, the way I see myself. Mm. I had an eating disorder as a teenager that I still held on to as a protective measure. And, it completely helped me process that as well, like things that I just thought were hard-coded and part of me. And it's learning that separation of the ego of, we all think that we know who we are, and yet we have no idea how infinite and flexible and brilliant we all are if we can actually get to our own material and we're not afraid to look at it. I hope that makes sense.
Would you be open to sharing some of your learnings? You said, you know,
yeah,
I didn't know myself. I don't know myself either, right? But I'm realizing more and more where I'm a giver by nature. I think, as you can see, my mission is all about giving the whole world, a billion people, if I can. And that basically means that I don't always allow myself to stop and say, but I need a few things. Also, being a successful sort of like very, very driven problem solver most of the time I can do shit on my own, so I don't demand that someone is there. So I'm starting to understand this, and that if you get the most giving, wonderful, loving woman in your life, which I had several times in my life, I sort of spoiled them, right? I sort of say, hey, baby, you don't have to do anything. I'm going to do everything, you know, and it's quite an interesting thing I'm admitting in public. Then I get upset and I say, why is no one giving me as much as I'm giving them? But I was the one that, you know, sort of said, don't give me, I'll be giving here. I'm the giver on this relationship. And it's clearer and clearer to me now. I mean, in a very interesting way, of course, it's still quite difficult how to learn to stop doing those habits and go to other habits. Tell me about your side. What was your biggest discovery?
Oh, wow. That's quite a question, because I've honestly, I've had so many. I don't know where to start.
We have time, Hannah.
I think you're not letting me get away with this, are you, Rob?
If you want to, I can, but I don't think the listeners will be happy about that.
No, I'm more than happy to share. I think what was interesting for me in the early days was how much we all project out, how much we project what we can't hold for ourselves and what we don't want to own for ourselves. And it's easiest to put onto somebody else our shadow material, if you like. And then using that shadow, and that's very Jungian thinking from Carl Jung. And the shadow is it's the material that we can't hold and we banish to the unconscious because we don't want to look at it. And that's maybe, that's often environmental. So maybe in my case, I was told never to show off. I was told not to get a big head, I came into this world, you know, singing and dancing and like a little lovable lunatic, wore my heart on my sleeve all the time. And I was always told to be quiet, that I was too much, I was embarrassing myself, that wasn't okay. And that's from family and at school. And so you just learn, like going back to that kind of data coding, you're processing information all the time and you quickly adjust. Like we have these fantastic minds that will quickly do a bit of a switch around and be like, okay, don't do that anymore, do more of this. And quite often, if there's a part of ourself, of our soul, our core nature, which is most on display when we come into the world as little kids, we're most ourselves when we're small infants. And I believe that children are so intelligent and we can learn so much from them. I think there's far too much infantilizing that goes on. But quite often, if a part of our core nature is rejected, we will start to become, we won't just dumb it down, we'll become the direct opposite. And usually people who are very cold and unfeeling and guarded quite often have the most love to give. And that's why it's so painful for them. And it becomes their shadow material and it becomes fiercely defended. And that was definitely my experience. And that's why it breaks my heart whenever I'd get feedback from people that said like, oh, you're very distant. You're very guarded. You're very cold. Because your soul knows, and it's like, no, I'm not. And it's there screaming inside. So I think that was an interesting realization that actually those parts of me are still alive. They're still in there, but it's learning to reintegrate them and learning that they're okay. And that the early information that I received is old information. And that's not the, you know, getting it into the conscious mind, into the here and now of going, okay, well, but what would happen if I express myself like this now? To these people, to this person. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I think that takes us back to that idea of feminine masculine. I mean, that one of the most guarded sides of us is the feminine. It's like it's weak, it's not very, you know, practical. What if he sees me? What if he knows me? And, you know, in my typical relationships, regardless of how feminine a woman appeared on the outside, when you give a woman space, more feminine would show up. So can I just agree the definitions before we go deeper into this? Yeah. Because I think a lot of our listeners may not understand what is feminine and masculine. I mean, how do you define them?
My definition of feminine masculine has nothing to do with gender. It's more about the active qualities of the masculine, the doing. And the feminine qualities are the receptive, so the being. And that's why we live in a hyper-masculine society, because we're not okay with just being. We fear it. We don't want to stay still. It feels unsafe. And so we're active, active, active. And that is irrespective of gender. That's everybody. And we are, as a collective, we're out of balance. And as individuals, we all feel out of balance as well. And that's a scary situation to be in, I think.
I think that's spot on. I couldn't agree more. I think it's a set of qualities by which we navigate the world, right? And I think you're absolutely spot on when you say one side is all the active qualities that lead to doing. And we've been trapped in a world that's all about doing, right? Even the you know, when you really think deeply about social media today, it takes core features of being, which is I am happy, or I am beautiful, or I am this, or I am that, and we turn it into doing. We take the camera out, we put it on a photograph, we type a few lines below it, because that state of being in itself is no longer enough. I have to start doing as I go through. And I agree with you 100%. It's not gender at all.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, it's a balance that if it's not in every one of us, you wouldn't be able to function in the world, or at least you wouldn't be able to function properly or happily.
Yeah, totally. And balance is actually a fundamental need for us to live contented lives. It's not just it's not something for Zen monks only, or it's not for those who, it's really important, because anything that is out of balance and really dominant will become a distortion and will become problematic. It's like an excess of medicine then becomes poison. It's the same concept. So, you know, we cut, like you said, like we have to have both, and they need to be relatively balanced in order for us to function. Otherwise, everything goes haywire. And that's kind of where we are at the moment.
But then how does the polarity play out then? I mean, it is not a secret that I would not be able to be with a woman who's not in her feminine, right? So I love that state of being that I crave to be complementing my state of constant doing, if you want, to bring me down to calm, to playfulness, to, you know, to a little bit of flow and so on. But at the same time, you know, I get upset eventually if there is no doing at all, right? So, where does that polarity play out? How do we get to know ourselves from inside in light of that polarity?
Well, can I maybe talk about the process of that kind of alchemy of relationships that I mentioned earlier? Because it might shed some light on your question.
Sure.
So, when we're looking for love, when we originally meet someone and we fall in love, it's actually all about us. It's all about the ego, and we think it's all about the other person. We feel consumed by the idea of this other person that we're interested in, but actually it's just us. And we are looking because we're seeking, and it makes sense with what you just said. We seek out the qualities that they hold that actually are within us, and they're the qualities we need to actualize to become fully whole. So we're chasing that, and we see it on that person. We see it mirrored, and we kind of fall in love with that version of ourselves. I know that sounds a bit wild.
Yes.
And so they hold those qualities for us, and that's what we're drawn to. Now, this is if people are reasonably healthy, I've got to say. Layer on top of that projections from childhood, attachment theory, all of these things. They take precedent. They'll go first and foremost. But if you've worked through that stuff, you're looking for the qualities of your inner. So for me, I would be looking for my inner masculine. So the type of man that I go for is actually my masculine side realized in a man. But then...
Wow. That is a very eye-opening statement for me. The minute you said this, I could easily see this within myself. Because should I say this publicly on a podcast in front of tens of thousands of people, I'm a kid. Like literally, if you let me, without all of the responsibilities of life, I'll be silly like they come and just play all the time. Right. And I do play quite a bit for what I've achieved in life. So I crave that part of me because I'm not living it, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
Is that what you said? We're looking for.
Yeah, absolutely. So is that, do you tend to go for people who are playful and fun?
I crave a woman that is playful and fun for sure. Do I tend to go for them? I have a selection bias to going for those who drain me. But did I say that? I love you all, everyone that came into my life. But, yeah.
Well, that draining, that might actually be other stuff. That might be, like I said, what will kick in first is more recent stuff from childhood. So it might be your attachment style, for example, or any kind of codependency, perhaps, that that might be at play. We don't have time to get into your whole history. So just, you know,
I'll book a separate session.
But yeah, there are lots of things that can get laid on top of that. But when we fall in love, really, really fall in love, it's usually that part of ourself. Now, however,
what is really fall in love?
Let me see. I'm someone who loves quite easily, I think. I've always loved people. I have a fascination in people. It's why I've ended up in this profession for sure. But to really fall in love, to really feel like something different, special is really happening, I think has happened once in my life, maybe.
For most of us, that's the case, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
So what is fall in love? I worked on that chapter, that definition within one chapter for a very long time. So what's the definition? What is to fall in love?
I don't know if it's the right vocabulary, but that's what we say, isn't it? We say fall in love because I think there's a surrendering almost to it. There's a way that we give in to a vulnerability of completely just being open to this other person.
That's such a beautiful feminine way of saying it. You know how the masculine says it? So my definition of this, it's so interesting. You know, the feminine definition is almost the same exact meaning, but my masculine definition is to fall in love is to reach a level of irrationality. You know, you reach a level of so being so into a person that you don't mind being irrational about them. Right? So, you sort of tell yourself, yeah, she annoys me, but I'm so crazy about her. Right? And I think that level of irrationality, again, of course, the masculine is thinking about rationality. You in the feminine is thinking about surrender and a state of being where I don't have to, you know, it's so such a beautiful complementary view of it. But in love, which I have to admit is the best feeling ever, because it's so liberating that you, even if you think about it from my masculine point of view, to be liberated from rationality and to say, it doesn't matter. This is so beautiful as it is. I want it as it is. And like you said in the feminine, I'm going to surrender to some of the things that don't work. And I asked hundreds of people, okay? And most people will say it only happened once. And I think that's because of fear. Because somehow, if it happened and I was so irrational about it, I was so in surrender, and it didn't work out, then I don't want to be in that pain again. Do you think that's true?
I think that's really true. And even though for me, it was fear that I sabotaged it. So when I was in love, I was in my early 20s and I had been raised in a very masculine environment. I've got four brothers. I was the only girl. My mom died as well when I was in my early 20s also. And I wasn't raised to value the feminine. I've worked through all of this now, I'm very happy to say, but I had a lot of internalized misogyny, I think, that I didn't value my own feminine. And so I thought in a very masculine way. I operated in a very masculine way. And I was terrified of that surrender. When I fell in love, it was the worst thing that had ever happened to me. It was terrifying. And I just did not know how to deal with it. I didn't know enough about myself. I didn't know enough about life and how to, you know, communicate and it was all just threatening to me. And so it did not go well.
Do we need in love?
We need love.
We need love for sure.
We need love for sure. I think you can get to in love. I think falling in love and being in love are almost two different things, I think. Because I think when you fall in love, that's like, it's this rush, this tumble of all of these new experiences, all of these new feelings, and that surrender, if you like, or that fall into, I can't remember how you put it now, but it sounded quite depressing.
It sounded just masculine, darling. That's the only difference. Just it came from the opposite side of your point of view, but it wasn't depressing. No.
Yes. Irrationality.
Irrationality.
Falling
exactly.
into like, irrationality.
How can men expect rationality? Like, what's wrong with you people, right? Because that's the only way we see life. You know, it's quite interesting. Yeah.
But if you go back to the model that I was framing earlier, where we seek those other parts, if then we can be in relationship with those parts, literally we're in relationship with those parts of ourselves, we start to integrate them. And what's beautiful is when a couple are really in a good, healthy relationship, they, because I believe you learn something from every single relationship you ever have, right. But you start to almost, it's not that you change each other, that's very different, but you organically start to, so if I'm with an extroverted person, I will start to become a little bit more extroverted, correct. And they will start to become a little bit more introverted. And there's this balance that's happening because you're actually integrating those parts of self and becoming more aligned. And once that's happened, that's why it's called alchemy, you know, this an alchemical process. Once that's happened, then you're free to really love the other person without projecting self onto them. You're fully able to see them for who they really are and love them. And then I think you can be in love with that person, because when you fall in love, you're usually falling in love with yourself.
Wow.
Does that make sense? That's a lot that I've just thrown at you.
Wow. That is so eye-opening, so wise, so interesting. I mean, let me repeat this if I got it correctly. So mm-hmm. I'll just first say you commented on the phase of falling in love. And believe it or not, for me, in my definition, this is nothing more but romance and passion, right? And romance and passion are just a chemical cocktail that is irresistible. Romance is that whole excitement and unknowing, but optimism at the same time. All incredibly interesting emotions with, of course, what you get when you're with someone for the first time, you're undressing them for the first time. And there is so much into this that this cocktail is just, it's basically a drug, right? Now, none of that really is actually falling in love. In my writing, I call it falling in love, lust or falling in romance, right? The way you defined it is so much like my happiness equation, where you basically end up in a place where you're with someone who's never perfect. Nobody is ever perfect. And then you suddenly go, but I love them exactly as they are. I don't love my projection on them, right? I don't love how they see me or how I see myself in them. I just love that person as they are. And that's to be in love. That's so different than the act of rush that we call falling in love. It's the being yeah. in love that matters. That is so beautiful, Hannah.
Yeah, I think a lot of us find it difficult to get to that stage.
Why?
Because we don't fully understand ourselves and what we're actually looking for and what we actually need. And that's the key part that's missing. That's the key bit that we need to do at the start, I think. And I fully believe that a lot of people don't know what it's like to feel, this is a bit of a negative statement, but to feel psychologically healthy, because they haven't in their adult lives. And so they just assume that this is a normal state of being, to be at unease with themselves.
If we think of it this way, does that not mean, I mean, the way I teach happiness is that happiness is to love what you have, not to want what you don't, right? You can't mm-hmm. precondition happiness on when I get this, I'll be happy, okay? Happiness truly is, oh my God, look at this amazing hour where I'm spending in a wonderful conversation with a wise, insightful person. Whatever is happening in the rest of the world, I should just love this hour, right? If you apply that to love and romance, does that mean that this ridiculous search for the one is not needed? That, interestingly, if you're with someone who hopefully is not a creep and is not really abusing you and so on, to just love them as they are, to stay, is that maybe a shorter path to finding love?
Yes, but I think as we have all experienced, it's not as random as tag, you're it, that, you know, there's got to be that initial chemistry. And I don't mean that by a certain set of, you know, how they look or whatever. There has to be that almost soul matching, if you like. Like I said, they've got to model the qualities that you are, that you have inside you yourself, but haven't come out.
Soul matching is not qualities you have inside you. So soul matching is a very different level. It depends on how we define souls.
Yeah, it does. It depends on the definition of soul. But if you're looking at the self, and so, like I said, you know, I'm drawn to people who embody my inner masculine, if you like, and you might be drawn to people who embody your inner feminine. So there's got to be that, because another man, because I'm attracted to men, that another man would not do that for me. So I'm not, it's not like I could just have a fulfilling relationship with him, because that process isn't going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite interesting when you said soul matching. Again, one of my deep thoughts, and I decided to never publish that, is an attempt to define what love itself is, right? So you could think of envy as, you know, I want what they have. It's an explicable. You can explain what envy is. You can say that hate is, you know, there is a major mismatch in our value set, right? You can explain that. But I actually have found that it's quite difficult to explain consciousness and love.
Yeah.
Right. And if I'm looking for like the type of physics definitions that we, you know, mathematicians and physicists would do, there isn't really any. And when you really go deeper, that might be because love doesn't fall under the scientific method. It's not something that's experienced in this world, if you know what I mean. It might be something that's experienced between the souls, not between the bodies, not between the physical forms, if you want. And when you said soul matching, my definition of love was a sense of longing that stems from belonging. So you long to be with another soul because you're already with that other soul in the soul paradigm. In a very interesting way, you already met. It's just that you're trying to get your physical forms to meet.
So soulmates.
So not necessarily a singular soulmate, if you assume that the soul world, the world of us in a spirit form, not necessarily is just two, okay? But it could definitely be, and I don't think of that as science at all, but in my attempt to explain to myself, why is it that you see someone for the first time and you already love them? You see a puppy and you love it. You see whatever. Huh? And you know, the fabric of love itself is not just romantic love. It's all kinds of love. Perhaps because you already know them, because you already belong with them somehow. And, you know, sometimes that manifests in the nurturing of a mother to her child, but sometimes it may manifest in the passion for a woman for her man, right? And it's the fabric of love itself is the same. And then you add to it a little bit of romance, a little bit of partnership, a little bit of companionship, and then you build a different relationship every time.
Yeah.
That soul matching comment.
I really love what you just said, because it is expanding on that, because I can see that need in you to always have the logical definitions of things and the answers.
That's why I fail at the topic of defining, you know, that book has taken me so long to write, because I'm trying to write it in a language that's not the language of love.
Yeah, but it's beautiful that you're even attempting to write it, because again, and what you're doing so fantastically is that you are holding those two parts and you're being open to finding definitions and getting that tangential information, whilst also being open to maybe we can't have all the answers. Maybe we can't see what's in front of us. And so I think that's interesting. And I think that's what, because again, a lot of my work, I love to think of things in a very logical, formatted way, whilst also knowing that sometimes you have to chuck that book out, and that lots of things, you know, there are those dualities. Two things can be true at the same time.
Yeah. So let's talk about your work, finally.
Okay.
I'm very interested first to start from the weightlift idea, because it is a very interesting definition of the stubbornness of the masculine. Okay. And I say that with love and respect. I mean, I, I, I have to admit, in my mind, it's actually easier to understand why men suck so much than it is to understand why women suck so much. Because I understand what it's like to suck like a man. So you know how it is. But and a big part of it is that idea of the weightlift, right? The idea of, especially alpha men, we will mm-hmm. not accept help. We will not even believe that we need help to start. So tell me a bit about that. Why did you choose this? What do you tell them?
Okay, so I developed the weightlift, and the name is a little tongue-in-cheek because I have this perpetual frustration that we, not just men, as a collective, we are very proactive when it comes to looking after our physical health. And that was not always the case. It wasn't that long ago that we knew very little about nutrition. You know, we didn't fully understand exercise. And now we're so proud to tell people that we're going to the gym, and men especially, you know, they want to tell you what they've benched that morning, and they're, you know, they're very competitive about it. They're there with their protein shake next to them and wearing it like a badge of honor. It's bizarre that we then have such an alien relationship with our psychological health and how we think about the mind.
Yeah.
And that I find really frustrating because it's exactly the same. And I think, again, ego comes into play because we seem to think that the mind is us. We seem to think that that's who we are, that's our personality, rather than something that needs to be worked with and trained and developed. And it's almost like the mind has mastery over the body, like it's the boss, and yeah. you shouldn't have to tell the boss what to do. The boss knows everything. Don't ever challenge it, you know? And then, so we're only reactive when it comes to our mental state, and we wait for things to go wrong. And we don't even have the same attitudes towards, so say your physical body, if you break your arm, you know, it's a classic example people use, you'll get a cast put on it. Everyone's like, oh, you know, never mind. I'll sign your cast. We'll wait for you. There's an understanding that they will heal and get better.
Yeah.
It's not a big deal. Sometimes things happen. But when it comes to the mind, there's a bit of an othering of, oh, something went wrong. There's a fear around it of, and it's definitive, like it defines you somehow in a way of you're weaker, you're not able to cope with life. And that's almost like you are somebody who is not able to mentally cope, rather than you're going through something and you'll get better, like you would a broken arm. Mm. And further to that, we're not educating people to begin with. So, you know, with an arm, we're also told not to run around and smash it into things, but we're not given that help with the mind at
exactly.
all.
No,
we're
no,
not
no.
taught.
Hit your head against anything you want. If it's in your
yes.
mind, that's fine. Yeah.
but exactly, we're not taught how to be in relationship. We're not taught how to be parents. We're not taught how to grieve. We're not given any of these tools. And then when things go wrong, it's like, oops, stay away from them. They clearly can't cope.
Exactly.
You know, I find it crazy. The mind needs to be exercised. It needs to be nourished. It needs to be supported, just like the body. It's exactly the same. So I am on a mission. If it kills me, I am on a mission. My life's work is going to be trying to get a reframe around how we see exercising the mind, just as for prevention rather than
preventive.
Because something's gone wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just for health.
Again, it's a very interesting overlap because Unstressable, my next book with Alice, is finally in its print ready version. So it's coming out in spring. And, you know, we have something in it that we call the Mind Gym, GYMMMMMM, so six M's. And the whole idea is that, you know, muscle atrophy will allow you to grow your muscles by going to the gym repeatedly. And then, you know, if you use HIIT exercises or whatever, you're going to increase your stamina and so on. It's very well understood now, not because it was when I was a teenager, but because we put our minds to understanding it. And I think, in reality, there are exercises, there are practices that you can take proactively so that your mind doesn't get you to hit the walls all the time and you know, keep you up at night and make you suffer, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And the course that I developed, the online program, is all around those basic foundation blocks that it's like the education piece that I think is missing from schools. So it will just tell you, and this kind of goes back to your earlier question, it'll teach you how you might be in relationships, what might come into play. It gets you to look at your childhood through an objective lens. And this is not, again, it's trying to break through all these preconceived ideas we have around psychology. I get such wild responses from people like, well, it's, you know, I don't want to blame my parents. My parents were brilliant. Yeah, okay. No one's coming after your parents. It's not about that.
Yeah.
It's just about understanding, oh, this is the data I received as a child. So these were the messages that was mapped onto that code. You can tell I'm not a coder, so I'm just going to get the metaphor all over the place. But that information is then forming how we see ourselves and how we see the world. It's not about blaming anyone that that gave us that information. It's just about understanding it, because then we've got the power, we've got the data in front of us so that we can work with it. That's all it is. And doing that with then, you know, that maps onto friendships, that maps onto, you know, the workplace, everything we do in life and looking for love. All of this stuff, we have information, key information about ourselves that we can then apply to all these different experiences to understand that, oh, that's why I'm really irrationally annoyed right now, but I know exactly why, because it was because of that thing. So then it's like calming down. So here's another physical example. You know, when you're on the treadmill at the gym and your heart rate, your heart's racing, you're short of breath, you know, there's all of these physical responses in the body, but you're not freaking out because you know what it means. You know that you're on a treadmill. It's the same. We get so out of sync with ourselves that we have these reactions, responses, and even to a heightened extent when people have panic attacks. It's because they don't understand what's happening. Yeah. They don't have a context to put it into like we would at the gym to go, oh, I'm just... Because imagine if that heart race and everything, which is a panic attack, happened in the middle of the street and you didn't have the context to say, I'm on a treadmill. It's very, very life-threatening.
Yeah.
So again, it's just having the framework to know, oh, this is because of this. It's a calming.
But why is that only for alpha men? I mean, that I think
it's not just for alpha men.
Yeah, for everyone, right?
Yeah, the weightlift is not just for alpha men. That's okay. Just a section that I particularly enjoy working with.
Yeah. If you take that idea of, I need to go back to understand my conditioning, to understand what is it that I'm attracting, and get to know myself, correct?
Yeah. What are my needs?
What are my needs? Are, is that what we're looking for? What are my needs? I mean, if you ask me, I need everything. Why not? No, it's interestingly, I mean,
what are your unconscious needs?
A big challenge with dating apps and social media, and, you know, in my case, being a little successful, is you get everything, right? So you start to tell yourself, oh, why not? I want someone who's gorgeous and funny and cute and at the same time super sexy, but very shy and whatever. I can ask for anything that I want, even if it doesn't make sense. It's not what I need. Is that what matters? Or is it more what would make me happy?
Are those things that you just described, are they actually what you need, or are they what you want in the present?
Are we back to therapy?
What do you actually need is a different thing.
Sit down.
You know, for that real, sit down, tell me about your day. What was actually, what do you really need for that connection, for that person that you're looking for? Because it seems like you can go after all these things, but it's not getting you what you need. It's getting you what you want, which doesn't last, because then you want something else.
No, I mean, in reality, my needs are listed very differently. Right. But even when I think about it now in my therapy session, my needs are not listed as needs. Right. So I, for example, want a woman who's spiritual, who believes in something more than our physical form, who is, you know, intelligent. That
to know what you need is go deeper than that. Why? Why? Why do you need someone who's spiritual? Why? It's always follow the why right down until you get to that core answer of, ah, okay, that's what I'm really looking for. That's what I need.
Why do I need someone who's spiritual? And my typical answer would be because I wasn't comfortable with someone who wasn't.
Why?
Because there is a mismatch in values.
And that's important because?
Because values matter and last longer than anything else. Don't they? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Man, this is a real therapy session in front of tens of thousands. I'm open for it. I think this is... Actually, one of the things I'm telling people is that it really is important for you to consult with another to see what's hidden, what's you know, not so clear within you. So why? Why do I want a spiritual person? I don't know the answer to that, to be honest. Other than it feels right to be with a spiritual person, no?
Well, why are you, what's your relationship with spirituality?
Oh, serious. It's the core of my life. It really is. I mean, you know, most people think of me as a physicist or mathematician, but at a very young age, I did the mathematics of the divine, as I call it, which was chapter 14 in Soul for Happy. And I basically recognized that relationships go two ways. One is in the physical world and one is in the spiritual world, and that the relationships in the spiritual world matter more. So to me, despite my approach to everything that I write, which is so logical and so, you know, engineered and so mathematical and facts-based, my entire life is dedicated to explore that other side.
Yeah. And I love that because you are almost like a human bridge to that other side, because the way that you write in Soul for Happy is so, it's so easy to understand. It's so clear and well laid out, but it is very spiritual. It is very enlightened.
It has to be. Anything that's not spiritual is not complete. I mean, that's not a correct statement. My view of the world is that anything that's not spiritual is only addressing half of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
In all honesty, addressing the half that doesn't matter as much. But let's go back to our listeners. You and I can.
We've gone off into another realm.
Yeah, but how does someone, like I gave an example here of I need someone in my life who's spiritual, but that's not the need. That's the description of who would fulfill that need, right?
Yes, exactly.
So how does one get to the need? The why? Give me an example on your side. What is a need?
Oh, great question. What is a need on my side? I need to be seen.
Correct.
For my true self without judgment and limitation, if you like.
So
that's what I need.
Let's go back upwards. For that, you need someone who's non-judgmental, who's inquisitive, who can connect deeply to you. You clever thing, you. That's a very interesting way of looking at it. I mean, I always go back to the idea that a woman has three needs: to be seen, safe, and if she's sexually active, to be had. And, you know, a man has three needs: to be free, seen, and if sexually active, to be given, right?
Yeah.
Or to take in an interesting way. So you take that seen bit and you say seen means those certain qualities in a man.
Yes. So just to layer on top of that, before I understood myself better, interestingly, so one of my core needs is to be seen. I would only be in relationships with men who were emotionally unavailable and could not see me. And that was because of my childhood stuff where I had an emotionally unavailable dad. And again, it's not about blaming the parents at all, but it's because we will constantly seek to repair something, because then it almost heals it. We think that's going to heal it, but we don't have that. Well, it feeds into attachment styles and transactional analysis and
Why don't we attract what we need? Why do we attract?
Because we don't know we need it. Because we haven't connected with ourselves fully yet. And that's why it's important to understand. That's why I'm saying we have to understand what our needs actually are. Otherwise, we're unconsciously just chasing after things that we think we need. We're trying to repair holes that were formed in another time in early childhood.
Are you willing to play this game? You just contributed one, I contribute one, then you contribute one?
Okay, sure.
So when you say it this way, I think my biggest need is to be free.
Interesting. Okay.
For many reasons, you know, throughout my entire life, I've accumulated lots and lots and lots of obligations, people that count on me in many ways, right? Including, for example, people who will expect a podcast once a week, right? And in my upbringing, which is hyper responsible, if I make a promise, I will fulfill, right? And so when it comes to my relationships, I want, not only do I not want someone who is going to add to my restrictions and obligations, I crave someone who is going to enable more of my freedom. Like, he will understand that if I have a talk for 12,000 people in an hour's time, and, you know, she may not be feeling perfectly, you know, happy at the moment, she will give me the hour of freedom so that I do my talk properly, and then we can talk later, if you know what I mean, right? So, mm-hmm. So that idea of, if I look at the list of 9 qualities I'm looking for in a woman, you would see that many of them would go back to free, right? Not free to roam around and do whatever I want, but free to feel a lightness in the relationship, that the relationship is not a jail, if you think about it.
Yeah. But do you think that we share a lot of these things? Because I'm thinking surely part of the human condition is a need to be free.
Correct. Also a need to be seen.
And a need to be seen and a need to be loved. Because I was thinking 100%. Loved and in some way special as well, I think.
That's part
but
of
I think
seeing.
Everyone...
That's part of seeing.
Yes, okay.
So the biggest part of seeing, which I have to say I never really fail at, is I think every human is beautiful. So, you know, in a beautiful way, if you manage to go through the traumas and see the core of your lover, they're amazing, right? Mm. And the thing is that, you know, if you genuinely ignore the negativity and trauma and just focus on the positivity and, you know, miracle of every human, you will have seen your lover. And I hosted Alain de Botton here on Slow Mo in season 1, and he was talking about that idea that the whole thing about love is to be able to undress, you know, figuratively and physically in front of someone and sort of show all of your taboos and all of the things that you hide from everyone else, with one wish where they go and look at you and go like, oh my God, that's amazing, right? That moment of being seen for exactly who you are, nothing covering you, and still being liked is a very deep desire within all humans.
Yeah, and that's real intimacy, and that's where the magic happens.
I believe that. I believe that this... One moment, I would tend to believe that this is more true for men than most women believe. It's just not, a woman would want to be seen as beautiful, for example, in the eyes of her man. A man would want to be seen manly. And manly is a different one. Manly is, I'm enough, I'm protective, you can rely on me, right?
And it's men want respect.
Yeah, respect. Yeah. We had Sarah Dawn Moore here on the podcast, and one clip that we put on Instagram from her conversation was about respect, that men want respect. And my God, we had like a million feminists attack her like mad.
Gosh.
Oh my God, I was like, what's wrong with you people? She's not saying that women don't need respect. She's saying, if you want to love someone, give them what they need, and men need respect. Mm. It was such an interesting response.
I think we all need both. We all need love and respect. But again, some of the conditioning in our environment has meant that it's more important, because if men don't get respect, it threatens much more for them than it does for women. And the same with love in the other way. Now, again, I don't want to come under fire here, but I just think that...
This is the clip that we will publish on Instagram.
But I truly believe that a lot of our environment has shaped us, because again, if you go back to the data idea, it's, we're learning all the time and we're being taught. So I use the example of, think about anger, how we express anger across the genders. Now, my dear old dad has often commented about, oh, bloody women, they're always crying. As soon as they get upset, they're always... And I'm like, well, it doesn't sound like she was upset. It sounded like she was angry. But it's not safe or acceptable for a woman to express her anger as readily as it is for it to come out of her eyeballs and to express herself in that way. Because if a woman suddenly bangs her fist on the table, that's really jarring for people. I'm not saying that's how it should be. I think it's ridiculous, but that's just how we're conditioned. Whereas if a man gets angry and he bangs his fist on the table, it's like, oh, he's such a pistol. But if he started to weep at the table, if he started to crumple, everyone would freak out.
Yeah.
And it would be, so it's what we learn is safe for us.
Mm.
It's all the same emotions at the end of the day.
Well, if it is,
it's
if
just
it is,
how we express them.
If it is, Hannah, then maybe we can, you know, extend this conversation an hour more and just write down all of the human needs and that's it, really. Okay? Because sometimes
we'll have solved everything.
Exactly, we'll have solved it completely. I mean, in a very interesting way, sometimes when I have such a deeply connected conversation, I think that it's all so easy. It really is. It's just see someone, see them for who they really are, learn that they're not perfect and so love the wonderful sides of them, accept the sides that are not perfect, we're all not perfect, and then maybe, I don't know, you know, just be able to express your needs when they're not met in a kind and compassionate way and, you know, have passionate sex, and then that's it, basically. Every couple would be happy forever. And you know, I know it sounds really simple, but doesn't that cover all of the needs that we've just discussed?
Yeah, it absolutely does. But again, the first part has to be that you're able to do that within yourself for yourself first, because otherwise you're projecting. Otherwise, you can't express your needs in a safe and loving way, because there's like barbed wire around all of it, and you're being activated by all these different things because there's still a lot of material in your unconscious that has not been realized yet. So healing those, just coming into contact with those. And that's why therapy is so beneficial, because it is a way of being seen. It's a way of first, it's like an entry to your first experience of really being seen, to be able to see yourself. It's that witness in front of another human being. You know, when you were saying that it takes someone else to be able to sort of hold yourself accountable almost. That's not what you said, but
to consult, honestly. Yeah, to consult, to get a different pair of eyes, basically.
Because we heal in relationship with one another.
That's very true.
We're not meant to be individuals alone in this world. We are social animals, and it's because we do need each other. We need that mirroring, just like a baby learns from the mirroring that it gets from its caregiver. We understand ourselves.
If that was the case, wouldn't it mean that, you know, that ultimate dream of one lifetime relationship is not really good for us, because we learn in relationships? I mean, in a very interesting way.
Yeah.
I had a one woman in my first 27 years of my life. And, you know, I've learned so much from her, but I definitely learned more when I had multiple relationships and, you know, pain and breakups and hurt. And, you know, there is something to be learned in each one of those, that harmonious, very long connection, deep and successful, most of the time, painful other times, doesn't really teach us that much.
I agree 100%. And as we know, we didn't used to live as long as we do now. And so it was a shorter term that you'd be in that relationship and that partnership. But we benefit from every single, even friendships, all of these relationships that we have, we learn so much. And I don't know what the model is, because also we change. So if I think of who I was in my early 20s, I'm not the same person now.
Correct.
So my needs are different as well. Jesus, and how I'm going to, it is also changeable. So I don't think there's a one person out there for everyone. But how our egos deal with the idea of not following that monogamous rom-com idea, I'm not sure.
Or, you know, how our hearts deal with a breakup, when a breakup is just an invitation, really, to say, okay, another lesson, another experience. You need it. You've learned from this one, and now it's time for you to explore and move on and get the whole cycle again.
It's like a career change.
Yeah, with a little more conditioning around it. It's like, imagine if people told you that when you leave your job and go to another job, it would be counted as a total failure, right? I think that's really the view of relationships.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, look, Hannah, first of all, oh my God, I don't know if I've covered any of your work at all, but that was such a lovely conversation that I don't know if I should ever publish because of how much I said about myself. But I really, really, really learned, actually, quite a few things, and it really benefited me. And I hope it benefits others. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did.
Oh, it's been, yeah, it's been a massive privilege. Such a joy.
On the other hand, I normally, I feel we could go on for another 4.5 hours, but normally when a podcast is so dense with gold nuggets, I'd ask my listeners to go back and listen to it again instead of spending another hour with us. First, I want to thank you deeply before I summarize what I learned. Really, thank you so much for coming. I'm really happy I followed my gut feeling on someone I met the first time 10 minutes in, because this truly has been one of my most enjoyable conversations on this podcast ever. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Mo.
For all of you listening, I really have to say that there is a lot of depth to the concept of loving the side that's within you that you find in someone else. I think that really opened my eyes. You know, the idea that we fall in love with ourselves, with what we need, maybe with the gaps within us, is quite eye-opening when you really think about it. And in a very interesting way, might be the easiest path. If you're open to the idea that love in itself is success, to have fallen in love is wonderful, but that love might be the school that takes you from one level of the game to another, so that it really gets you ready for perhaps what could be your ultimate eventual love, then there is a lot of joy in deeply visiting yourself and understanding where your tendencies are coming from. Because I will say openly, it's been on my mind very strongly in the last couple of weeks that it wasn't the women that came into my life that were not compatible with me, even though many of them were incredible women. I think they know themselves, and many of them gave me so much, but that it was me that needed to change. I think that truly and honestly is a very eye-opening place to be in, and makes me optimistic in an interesting way. Well, whatever it is that you find useful in this conversation, I'd urge you to go back and listen. I think it's been quite a wise conversation for me. I hope it has been for you as well. Don't forget to subscribe if you're on YouTube. Rate the podcast 5 stars if you haven't already, if you're on a podcast player. And spread it to others if you can, because the more people that will get this message, the more able I am to get more and more of those conversations your way. Either way, I think this requires you to take a little bit of time every week, hopefully to come join us and listen to another interesting concept, but also to just slow down and really reflect on life and who you really are. I love you all for listening, and I will see you next time.